Okay, I guess we'll start here. Today's date is April 16th, 2024, of the Common Era, and the time is 1915 hours Eastern Daylight Time. Ward Green with you again for our study, Little Children, of the Crucible article. And in studying that, we've referred to the Wild Road article also. In paragraph 1-8, where it talked about the dead reckoning, as it's called, when you add up the reigns of the kings. It's called dead reckoning. And we dead reckoned from the time of Akhenaten back to Amos yesterday. And also, we talked about the time of King Tut, this chart. Chart 1, it's called, in the article before, it's called Before or History of Babylon, Part 1, Chapter 2, Paragraph 11, at the end of that paragraph, a moon alignment reconstructing Neet Amarna, the acronym for that spells Amarna, that's Chart 1, and we see that when we allow that Tut's Year 1 began before February 16th of 1357, then we have a year 8 date, which is February 13th, 1350. In other words, 7 full years plus a little more after the accession of Tut. And in that year 8, we have a date, Famenoth 20, which in the book Ancient Egyptian Chronology from 2006 is the year 8 of 22-3 Parrot, or Famenoth, which is a decree for the overseer of the treasury, Maya. And that decree, these decrees for the treasury, that's typical of something you would see. At least this is what occurred to me, the decrees. Not the stelas, but the decrees tended to be the full moon. So at least that's what I noticed. They liked the new moon, but decrees, I found it was more reasonable to correlate those to the full moons. And that's what happened here. It correlated well. In fact, it was an astronomical full moon, the 17th day of the lunar month. And you notice in this chart, not just year 8, but all the years, I've indicated for alternate year ones, like year one here, the three different year ones for King Tut that were illustrated in this table. In the Wild Robe, we say 1355, which results in different alignments and doesn't result in a full moon in year 8, which we can see right here. Well, I've already gone away from it, but let's just see where it was now. Let's see where it was. Can I jump down to it? 1355. Should be here somewhere. I just looked at it a moment ago, but I wanted to go back and show the other information. Let's see what we can find here. Here it is. That might be it there. There's a lot of discussion in the Wild Road article, but I think it's, okay, let's look it up. Year 8. I just search for year 8. I'll find it that way, I'm pretty sure. Has to be found, right? There it is. Yeah, it's a lunar day 5, you see. In year 8, that's again paragraph 1-8. It's the same paragraph of the Wild Road article. Fascinating. But earlier on in that paragraph, we see that lunar day 5 is year 8. Wait a minute. Now, what is it? 3 Parrot. Yeah, Famenoth 22. It's the same thing. It's February 12, 1347. Only if we take that lower year 1 of 1355, which doesn't even really work because it's 8 full years, is it not? I mean, some of these don't work because it's November, for example, for the year 6 date. November 1349 is almost certainly 6 full years unless Tutankhamun came to the throne very late in the year 1355. So there may be problems with this later article, The Wild Robe. When we changed the reign of Tut, we were looking for other alternative answers, other answers for his year one, but we came back eventually to this year one. 1357 was the best, before, that is, February 16, 1357 for Tut, as the start of his reign. But when you see this illustration of these different year ones, year one, 1353, would result in the moon falling in this position, which would be too late for the actual date, which is the purple bottom square here. 1357, the moon falls just before the new moon. And 1350, the 1353 I did very, very lightly. You can barely see it. It's so light in color. And then 1350 was one that was closer to the time of the new moon, much even better, but it actually fell, well, it's a little bit earlier actually, not better but worse than 1357, which falls closer in time to the date in that year, Koyak 19, that was recorded in Tut's year 6. And Tut's tomb was in the Valley of the Kings in Thebes, which is not Amarna, because Tut, after some point, perhaps his year 4, which is the first year for which we have a date for him recorded in a tomb in Saqqara in the north of Egypt. Perhaps that was the year when he moved Amarna. He moved the Egyptian capital back from Amarna, that is, closing Amarna and moving back to Thebes. So we have, but we look at his, the alignments for Tut are phenomenal. His year 4 date in the tomb is a religious full moon date, the 15th, and also an astronomical full moon as well, indicated by the orange color surrounding the yellow. The orange is the astronomical full moon, and that was year 8 also, that was an astronomical full moon for that date in the purple. This purple date coincides precisely, almost precisely, that is, very closely with the astronomical and religious, both of them being coincident, full moons. And year 6 and year 7, we see it's remarkable, either lunar day 2 or lunar day 1 falling immediately after the new moon for those years, which were 1352 and 1351 respectively, and the indications for which were the gray box with a 1 in white color inside the gray box, the numeral 1. So that's the chart on Tutankhamun. It's a remarkable chart with 4 dates during his reign, all of which are either exact lunar day 1s, or perhaps just slightly after that, which would make them lunar day 2. Or if they're not lunar day 1s, they are, in fact, the other 2 dates, which are exact astronomical full moons. So the alignment for Tut is so perfect in the year 1357, we're not really easily able to change it at all. In our study of the Crucible article now, we've been reading this, the table we've been studying in chapter 10, paragraph 3 of part 2 of the Crucible, Crucible of Credible Creed, C3 article. And we saw that the solar eclipse of 1340 is the most convincing astronomical date, in quotes, convincing astronomical, because it's important. Well, I mean, it's been studied by people other than me. And I'm quoting from somebody, and I think it's from Peter Huber there, saying it's the convincing, the most convincing astronomical date. But with the attack of the Sea Peoples documented in year 8 of Ramesses III, this is another point, in that attack was the reign in 1222 of Meli Shipak II, right, might be more correctly 1217, because in his year 2, we know that coincided with the year 8 of Ramesses III. So 1216 is year 8 of Ramesses, is what that's saying, which we've already documented with Ramesses III in 1223, year 1. 7 years later is 1216 BCE. So therefore, Meli Shipak should be 1217, because we know that his year 2 aligned with the year 8 of Ramesses III. That's why we dated Meli Shipak. We adjusted him to 1217. And, you know, we have the chronology that works. If you look at any other conventional chronology, which I was looking for when I started out, you cannot go all the way up using conventional chronology. You'll meet an obstacle and you'll be stopped at some point when things don't work anymore, when you can't make reality conform to the chronology. So that's why it was necessary to make all of these changes and improvements to the chronology that we did. So we know, for example, this year 2 of Meli Shipak II must correspond with year 8 of Ramesses III, and it does in our chronology. Also, this year 8 of Ramesses is believed sometimes as being the end of the Hittite Empire, which is dated 1217-1216. That's year 8 of Ramesses, 1216, and that's the end of the Hittite Empire, as we discussed already. And when we look at the Hittite Empire, we're going to take an abbreviated reading of this paragraph, because we've used up some time already and we have some more studying to do in the scriptures. But we've already talked about this. Hattusili III reigned in 1294, and he's the one who, immediately after he took the throne of the Hittite Empire, established a treaty with Ramesses II in the year 21 of Ramesses II, who was the great, great king who ruled for 66 years in Egypt, from 1315 to 1249 BCE. Now, the Hittite king Tudhaliya IV succeeded Hattusili III in 1264. He reigned until 1236, and that left just 20 years for the last king of the Hittites to reign, who was Supaluliuma II, who reigned from 1236 to 1216. That's the end of the Hittite Empire, 1216, as we just said. Now, of the significant Hittites, there are 7 reigns, averaging 23 years per reign in that time period, from the beginning in 1377, Supaluliuma I, ending in 1216. The average is 23 years per reign for 7 reigns. And we know from analysis and study of averages, statistics, we know, according to Mr. Crosthwaite and other people, well, Isaac Newton thought it was a smaller number, but Mr. Charles Crosthwaite, in his book Synchronology from 1839, he said 22 years was the perfect number to use, or 21, for the average reign of a king, provided each successive king was not the son of the one previous. So an average would be less than the generation of firstborn sons, which is 27 years or 28 years or 26 years. So 23 or 22 for reigns where one of the succeeding kings might be a different person, like a brother or something like that. And that works out beautifully in this example of the Hittites, 23 years per reign instead of, you know, because they weren't all father and son. And then when we do only have 4 average generations, at least we don't know they were father and son. The average generation that we do know are 4. We have 4 generations from 1377 to 1236. Is that true? Yeah. 1307 to 1236, the average generation. We have that, right. So, and that is, yeah. I mean, I haven't looked at it recently. These are 2 of the year ones of 2 of the kings, but I'm sure it's correct as far as I can ever have made it. I work very hard on all of this, but it's 4 generations of 35 years average generation, which isn't, it's not a problem if they had a 28-year difference at the time of the year one, with the first king being younger by 28 years than the last king, then the average would be 28 years per generation, because 4 times 7, with a 7-year difference in average, would be 28 years in total difference of age for the first compared to the last. So even then, it could have been firstborn sons. It wouldn't have to be that every time the firstborn son succeeds, because maybe the firstborn son died. But the average of 35 is certainly reasonable. Then we have seen that our true chronology differs by between 30 and 46 years from the conventional dating, from the time of the Assyrian king Tukulti-Ninurta I, 1254 BCE by us, or 1243 by convention. It's not much different, only 11 years different between our date for Tukulti-Ninurta I. Isn't that amazing? And for the conventional date of Tukulti-Ninurta, you can look it up in, right now it's in Wikipedia, I just checked it. Still is 1243. And we have 1254, only 11 years higher. Now, also, from the time of that king, Tukulti-Ninurta, to King Ashurnasirpal II, King Ashurnasirpal II, they have some tongue-twisting names. 930 by us or 884 by convention. There's a big difference up there of 46 years between those two. And we've adjusted that, as we have explained, and as is also explained in detail by Mr. Oppert in his wonderful book or letter he wrote, the French version of which is La Chronologie Biblique Fixée par les Éclipses Cunéiformes. Right here, La Chronologie Biblique Fixée par les Éclipses des Inscriptions Cunéiformes. Mr. Jules Oppert wrote a letter to Monsieur Lenormand, I think is the name of the man he wrote the letter to. Anyway, it's a very beautiful exposition of the chronology. But in English, where did I put it? Here it is. Yeah, here's the English translation that I made. And he explains here that because of the date of the death of Solomon, as well as the missing reign of the King Pul, and the accession date of Sennacherib on page 8 of this article, that, you know, the date of the death of Solomon necessitates, and as do these other things, that we adjust the solar eclipse, which was called the Bursa Galli eclipse, wrongly dated 763 by convention, but at the time they dated that, they didn't know that the eclipse of 809 actually was perfectly acceptable, because they weren't calculating the eclipses the same way as they did later, by the time of his article that he wrote, and the date of his article. There is a different solar eclipse. We're going to talk about that tomorrow, I think. Now, the date of his article was... What was the date of his article here? What did we say it was? I've got to get to page 1 again. Here it is. Right. 1868, looks like, yeah. So by that time, they were able to calculate eclipses more accurately, and 809 became the better eclipse to use, 46 years higher than the 763 eclipse. But there was a prominent archaeologist who had endorsed the 763 eclipse, as Mr. Oppert explains. And so it had been the one adopted, and they had used that chronology to shorten the reigns of the kings of Israel in the Bible. Even they shortened they overlapped the reigns without any evidence or basis for doing so, and they changed the Assyrian chronology by omitting the king Pul, the existence of whom Mr. Oppert acknowledges, as do other people who ruled for 46 years. And Tiglath Pelezer, the third, right, in our chronology, in the table that we've been studying, he is one of the descendants in the nine generations from Ashur-dan the second, who was 1215, or the first, Ashur-dan the first was the first one. Ashur-dan the second was 981, right, in our chronology. Those nine generations from Ashur-dan the second down to Shalmaneser the fifth included Tiglath-Pileser the third, and he is the son of Ashur-nirari the fifth. And when you look at the averages, the average generation comes out to 28 years. There's no problem. So this intervening king pool was necessary in order to actually have the average be 28 years per generation. So he doesn't cause any problem. On the contrary, he resolves the problem that did exist in the generational average. So it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to know about, and it resolves our chronology quite brilliantly. Have we got this? Here's our daily study. Yeah, and by the way, the tomb of Tutankhamun, well, I showed you that already, right, is in the ancient Egyptian chronology book on page 208 of that book, the article written by Eric Hornung on the New Kingdom Kings from 2006 Ancient Egyptian Chronology. Our proverb for today, little children, is from Proverbs 15 and 16. The days of the needy are seemingly bad, the heart of the merry, perpetual glad. A little with fear of Jehovah is grand, and better than treasure with trouble at hand. Okay, that's our proverb for today, 15, verses 15 and 16. In the book of Ezra, chapter 2 now, it's a very long chapter, so I don't think we're going to have time to read that because we're nearly getting out of time already. But, I mean, we don't need to read it all. It's just a list of names. I've read it personally, but, I mean, you're advised, you're more than welcome to read the whole thing. It's wonderful to read all these names. But these were the sons of the jurisdictional district that went up out of the captivity of the exiled people, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had taken into exile at Babylon, and who later returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each one to his own city, those who came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, Sariah, Realiah, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mizpar, Bigvai, Rehum, and Baana. And the numbers of them were given here, the numbers of the men of the people of Israel, the sons of Parosh, 2,172, etc., 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 for all the different sons of different people, the different tribal groups. And then you go all the way down to verse 36, the priests also, 973 for the sons of Judea of the house of Jeshua. Then he gives the sons of Immer 1,052, etc., etc., for the other sons of other priests, and the Levites also he gives. Verse 40 through 42. The Nethinim he gives from verses 43 all the way down. None of them mention the name Ezra, because Ezra didn't live at this time. He lived in the next century, or he was at least known from his work in the next century. Could have been alive at this time, we don't know, but he would have had to have lived a very long time if he was alive at this time. This is the time when they returned, which is about the year 538 BCE, from Babylon to Jerusalem. The Israelites were returning, and the sons of the servants of Solomon are mentioned, verse 55, as returning, and all the Nethinim and the sons of the servants of Solomon in grand total here in verse 58 were 392. And it gives even more, those who couldn't tell the house of their fathers and their origin. It gives those and the numbers of those. And they, in verse 62, could not establish their genealogy, so that they were barred as polluted from the priesthood. Consequently, the Tirshatha, That would be the governor, I think, we were saying, right? The Persian title for a governor of a jurisdictional district. The Tirshatha, that would be Zerubbabel, said to them that they could not eat from the most holy things, they could not eat from until a priest stood up with Urim and Thummim. So the entire congregation as one group was 42,360, verse 64. Right? And their horses were 736. But also their men slaves and their slave girls were 7,337. They had 200 male singers. They had 435 camels and 1,720 asses, verses 65 through 67, and certain ones of the heads of the paternal houses on coming to the house of Jehovah, Yahweh, which was in Jerusalem, made voluntary offerings to the house of the true God to cause it to stand on its own site. According to their power, they gave gold for the working supplies, 61,000 drachmas, and silver, 5,000 minas, and 100 robes of priests, and the priests and the Levites and some of the people and the singers and the gatekeepers and the Nethinim took up dwelling in their cities, and all Israel in their cities. And that is all for Ezra chapter 2. There's a long list of names with numbers of each group of people that are mentioned. It's a wonderful thing to read if you enjoy reading names and seeing, because maybe you've got ancestors among them, who knows. It's fascinating to me to read names, and perhaps it is for you. Zechariah chapter 6, we have 5 minutes or so. Then I raised my eyes again and saw, and look, there were four chariots coming forth from between two mountains. This is the year 520 when Zechariah wrote, which is 18 years after the time that Ezra wrote about, which we just read about. And the mountains were copper mountains. In the first chariot there were red horses, and in the second chariot black horses, and in the third chariot, little ones, there were white horses. Not little horses, but white horses. And in the fourth chariot, horses speckled, particolored. And I proceeded to answer and say to the angel who was speaking with me, "What are these, my lord?" So the angel answered and said to me, "These are the four spirits of the heavens that are going forth after having taken their station before the Lord of the whole earth. As for the one in which the black horses are," these are the chariots referred to as having horses of different colors, "they are going forth to the land of the north. As for the white ones, they must go forth to behind the sea. And as for the speckled ones, they must go forth to the land of the south. And as for the particolored ones, they must go forth and keep seeking where to go in order to walk about in the earth." Then he said, "Go, walk about in the earth." And they began walking about in the earth. In the Insight, or the Watchtower, is it? Yeah, it's the Watchtower. Watchtower, October 2017. Right. No, that's not what I was looking for. I think I'm looking for in the fourth chapter. Yeah, I'm looking for the, I think it's a Watchtower reference I'm looking for here. But maybe not. No, it's from Watchtower. It's the same article, I think, October 2017. "Chariots and the Crown Safeguard You," paragraph 6, from October 2017, the Watchtower. It says, "The horses pulling the chariots are of different colors. This would help to distinguish one rider from the next." That's what it says. "And as for the particolored ones, they must go forth and keep seeking where to go in order to walk about in the earth." Verse 7. Then he said, "Go, walk about in the earth." And they began walking about in the earth. And he proceeded to cry out to me and speak to me, saying, "See, those going forth to the land of the north are the ones that have caused the spirit of Jehovah to rest in the land of the north." And the word of Jehovah continued to occur to me, saying, "Let there be a taking of something from the exiled people even from Helde, and from Tobijah, and from Judea, and you yourself must come in that day, and you must come into the house of Josiah, the son of Zephaniah, with these who have come from Babylon. And you must take silver and gold, and make a grand crown, and put it upon the head of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. And you must say to him, this is what Yahweh of armies has said. Here is the man whose name is Sprout. That word sprout we've talked about before as a prophetic illustration. It was given by Isaiah, mentioned in Zechariah also, the same book we're reading now, in chapter 3, verse 8, and was also mentioned by Jeremiah, as we've seen, in the article Born and Raised Messiah, for example, our most recent article by yours truly. It mentions this word sprout also. And from his own place he will sprout, and he will certainly build the temple of Jehovah. And it's of course prophetic, not just of Jeshua the high priest, but also of Jesus, for his name was also Jeshua, or Jehoshua, or Jesus in Greek. And he himself will build the temple of Jehovah, which we know Jesus has done. And he, in a spiritual sense, did it. And he, for his part, will carry the dignity. And he must sit down and rule on his throne. And he must become a priest upon his throne. And the very council of peace will prove to be between both of them. And the grand crown itself will come to belong to Helam, and to Tobijah, and to Judea, and to Hen the son of Zephaniah, as a memorial in the temple of Yahweh. And those who are far away will come and actually build in the temple of Yahweh. And you people will have to know that Jehovah of armies himself has sent me to you, and it must occur, if you will without fail, listen to the voice of Jehovah your God. That's the end of Zechariah chapter 6 now, and we're just about at the end. We've come to the time about 1 minute before we want to conclude our video. So that worked out well as far as time goes. So this is an important prophecy because it refers not just to the high priest Jeshua, who actually lived at that time, but Jesus, who was yet to come, to be born yet in the year BCE 6, as we've carefully documented in the article, Born and Raised Messiah, which is also available in several languages, 10 languages of the written form of language. It's available in 10 written languages on our website, willofjehovah.com. That's all for the video. It's April 16th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 1948 hours Eastern Daylight Time. That's the year when Israel, in the modern day, became a nation, amazingly. In my behalf, I love you very much, by the way. I do love you. I'm trying to get to the end here. This is Liv Dusty in my behalf, and also Cassie saying bye for now.